In the first lesson of this audio course on Lean UX, we explore how to convince others of the need for user research and explore the different techniques available for understanding your users better. This course is free thanks to the support of Balsamic. Hello and welcome to the new season of the Boag World Show. This podcast is hosted by myself, Paul Boag, and joining me is Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. So I can't really say much then.
No talking. It's very different. No, it's a new season, and we're going to do things a little bit differently this season. While traditionally this show has been very much a kind of chat show where we've talked about different topics and waffled a lot, we decided we're going to try having a season where we're really doing a audio course. So we felt that there was far too many chat show type format web design podcasts already out there, and that we had nothing different to offer to other people. But we equally saw that there was a space in the market, so to speak, for an audio course where you can learn valuable material while you're at the gym, while you're doing housework, while you're commuting. The kind of thing that maybe you would learn traditionally over YouTube, but obviously on YouTube or something like Skillshare, you have to be sitting at your desk. With this, you can be out and about. So we're going to try the new format. Hopefully everybody enjoys it. And the season is going to be an audio course on truly lean UX. In other words, how we can implement user experience design best practice in a fast, effective and cost efficient way. And that's what we're going to be looking at. So there's a lot of people that talk about lean UX, and then actually it becomes quite heavy and quite complicated and quite difficult. We're going to pare it back to the absolute minimum. So just to tell you a little bit about the new format, we're going to be moving to a monthly model so that between each lesson, you've got time to digest what you've learned, implement what you've discovered. We're also going to be setting some optional homework. I say optional. We can't make you do it. So
will you be marking it, Paul? That's more the point.
No, I won't be marking your homework. So things that you could go away and do between shows. So that's how it's going to work. So you can follow along with the season, because obviously you want to not only know about what's happening with the season, but also there is additional material that I'm producing that kind of complements the audio segment of the course. You can find out more about that by going to boag.world/lean-UX. So all the course material is at boag.world/lean-UX, boag.world/lean-UX. So that is the first part. Marcus, you look like you have a question about this season.
I wanted to reassure everyone that there will be some pointless banter, no doubt. There is, as I'm speaking right now. But also, more importantly, there will still be a joke at the end of the show to keep everyone listening.
Oh, yes. Nothing else to say.
Yeah, that's it.
That's fine. If you feel like you're missing out on the pointless banter that we've done in previous seasons, then by all means join our Slack community at boagworld.com/slacking, because we do have like Zoom meetups and things like that there. Okay, so let's get into this season of the podcast and this course on truly lean UX. This first episode, we're focusing on lean user research, how we apply user research techniques in an environment where no one's willing to spend the time or spend the money on doing proper user research, which is a common problem that we've all experienced. So what we're going to do in the show is I'm going to give you a short talk of about 20 minutes where we're going to look at the topic. Then Marcus has interviewed somebody about this topic and is going to unpack it a little bit further. So that's how the shows are going to work out. So let's jump right in straight away with my talk on how to improve your project with lean user research. How well do you know your users? It's a question I get asked all the time, and I'm surprised at how often digital teams say they don't really feel that they've got a good handle on who their users are and what they want. Of course, that's where user research comes in. But the problem is that user research can feel intimidating, and anyway, stakeholders often prevent it from happening. To address that, I want to use this talk as a kind of introduction to user research. I want to share with you 10 techniques of how to improve your understanding of your users. But before we jump into those techniques, we need to begin by answering the more fundamental question, which is why even bother with user research? If you're listening to this, you're probably already convinced of the value of user research. However, no doubt you have clients or colleagues who are less enthusiastic. It's not unusual to hear stakeholders claim that they already know their users really well, and that negates the need for user research. Unfortunately, this attitude is hard to combat despite being untrue. According to some research carried out by Forrester, for every $1 that's spent on UX, you'll see between $2 and $100 in return. That's a return of 100% up to 9,000%. There has been much research carried out in this area, and user experience design and user research have been shown to prevent wasted development time by about 50%, to reduce overall development time by 33%, to increase sales by 30%, and to decrease your bounce rate by 50%. And it will cause a 70% increase in the quality of your products. However, probably the best argument for user research is that 70% of projects end up failing due to a lack of user acceptance. And this is not just academic research either. IBM claims to see a $100 return for every $1 invested in usability testing, while Amazon saw a $300 million addition to revenue thanks to UX changes. Meanwhile, McAfee saw a 90% reduction in support costs through a redesign of their online experience. Of course, those are all big companies who have been able to do a lot of research. However, even the smallest amount of research will provide tangible value. If you're facing reluctant stakeholders, start small. Even a single survey or three user interviews will lead to better results. Also, ensure the amount of research you do is proportional to the size and complexity of your project. Don't push to do a lot of user research on a small project with a relatively low budget. That said, as you can see, user research works. The question then becomes, what do you need to know about users? In my experience, most of the research into target audiences within an organization has a marketing slant to it. For example, if you look at the average persona, they tend to focus on demographic information and personal taste. From a marketing perspective, that makes a lot of sense. To appeal to somebody, you need to understand their values and their attitudes. But when creating a great user experience, our user research needs a different focus. When I undertake user research, the emphasis is placed more on what the person wants to do rather than the kind of person they are. Both are useful, but focusing on what a person wants to do informs content, site structure, and functionality. In particular, I tend to look at the following areas. Number one, the user's journey. An interaction doesn't happen in isolation, it's part of a larger journey. The user passes through many steps before and after interacting with your website. Understanding these steps is crucial to designing a good experience. Number two, the user's questions. Most users come to a site with questions that they need answering. Those could be as broad as, does the company provide the service I need? To specific questions around how your offering works. If we don't know what those questions are, then the website is not going to meet their needs. Then there's user objections. Many of the questions the user has are concerns or objections. These are the reasons why they might hesitate to take action, so we need to know what those objections are so we can address them. Next up, there's user tasks. Users don't only have questions, they also want to do things on your website. That might be buying something or contacting the company, and a good website has to support these tasks, and so we need to be clear about what they are. Then there are the things that are influencing the user. Users aren't making decisions on your website in a vacuum. A range of things, from reviews to your competition, all influence their behavior. and user research should uncover what these influencing factors are so that you can address them. Next, there's what interaction the user has with your company. Again, the website doesn't exist in isolation. Users interact with your company in lots of different ways. They might use online channels like social media, but also offline channels like your call center. Understanding where the website fits into these interactions is essential. We also need to know what the user's state of mind is. And it's an area that's often overlooked in user research, and yet it plays a big part in how people view your website. Our state of mind impacts our cognitive load and the time we're willing to invest on a site. Then, of course, there's the user's ultimate goal. When a user comes to your website or uses your app, they're trying to achieve something. They have a goal that they want to reach, and understanding that goal helps us accommodate better the user's needs. And then there is also pain points. The pain points a user is trying to overcome, because often that goal is to address a problem that they're facing. This pain point has driven them to look for a solution, and they want to know whether your company can provide that solution. User research will reveal what that problem is and how the user expresses it in their own mind. We also need to know what touch points the user selects. How does the user choose to interact with your organization? Do they use social media or your website or your mobile app? What about offline touch points? Do they prefer the phone or visiting a store? Which touch points do they prefer at what point in their journey? Then finally, there's the user's context. For example, where is the user likely to be when they're interacting with your company? Are they likely to be in a busy office, grabbing a moment between meetings, or home relaxing in the evening? The user's context will impact their state of mind and also what device they're likely to be using. So now we know the kind of things that we want to learn about our users, let's look at the techniques that we can use to uncover that information. Organizations often know far more about their customers than they actually realize. The problem is that information is often distributed across the entire organization. For example, the customer service team may well have records on common questions they get asked when customers call them. Equally, the salespeople spend time with users every day and so understand a lot about them and the way they think, and in particular, the objections they have to buying. Then there's the marketing team who've done their market research, and the IT department who have access to analytics. Before you do more research, check that you have access to everything the organization already knows about its customer. Doing this will not only make you much more informed, but it will also help you identify gaps in your knowledge which you can fill with user research. Now, when it does come time to fill in those gaps in your knowledge, we've got an enormous range of different techniques that we have at our disposal. And so what I want to do is outline 10 and explain a little bit about each of them. Number one is surveys. Surveying has long been a tool for market research everywhere, and you can use it for user research too. There are two types of surveys that I particularly favour when carrying out user research. These are top task analysis and barrier surveys. Top task analysis is a technique for understanding of what it is that users want to achieve on your website. And there's an excellent post on A List Apart explaining the technique in more detail, and I would encourage you to go and check that out. You see, top task analysis is particularly useful for informing your information architecture and your visual hierarchy. Barrier surveying seeks to understand what barriers are preventing the user from taking action on your site. And to achieve that, we display a survey when users go to leave the website without taking action. The survey will then ask them why they decided not to act and provide them with multiple options to choose between. Second technique you can adopt are interviews. Interviews are the backbone of user research, and they're held in normally one of two formats, individually or in groups. Both have their place, and the group format can be appealing because it allows you to talk to many people simultaneously, but I tend to favour interviewing people individually. Individual interviews avoid group dynamics and quiet people getting overlooked, and they also avoid dominant people swaying the entire discussion. Now, there's no magic formula for doing interviews and no set questions you should ask, but often the conversation will cover areas such as the user's background, their use of technology, how they go about using your product, the user's objections and motivations, and their pain points. Next technique is mapping workshops. If you do decide to meet with people in groups, you might want to carry out a customer journey mapping workshop. Instead of interviewing people, carrying out a series of exercises to visualize what their experience is like tends to work very well. A mapping workshop helps you to get to know your users, but it also provides you with deep insights into their journey and the various issues that they are likely to have during it. Not that journey mapping is the only workshop exercise you can do with users. There are lots of opportunities to include users in the design process that provide all kinds of insights into their goals, questions, tasks, and pain points. You can involve users in creating wireframes for key pages. You can get them mood boarding or writing content. In fact, most of the exercises that we do with clients on a regular basis could be improved by involving users in the mix too. Then, of course, there's card sorting. The most common way of including users in the design process is card sorting. Card sorting helps to ensure that the user interface is built around the target audience's mental model, and it also avoids falling back into organizational jargon. Now, there are two ways of doing card sorting, open and closed. Open asks users to organize content in any way that makes sense to them, while closed card sorting gets users to arrange content into predefined categories. In either case, you learn a lot more about the user's mental model through card sorting. You also learn about the kind of information they want, as well as telling you if there is any content that might be missing. Another alternative to user interviews is usability testing. Now, you could argue that it's not really a user research technique because it's about testing the interface rather than understanding the person. But usability testing does provide valuable insights into the user. It helps us to understand their mental model, tasks, questions, and general approach. The fact that usability testing provides insights into both the interface and the user, actually, I think, makes it an efficient use of time. Also, the outcomes can feel more tangible than an interview. Because usability testing is about the interface and not the participant, I also find that people tend to relax a little bit more and open up. That helps gain valuable insights into their thinking that would be missed if they were a little bit more guarded. You can carry out usability testing remotely, but if you're looking for insights into the people that you're testing with, I would actually recommend meeting with them in person. You're going to miss a lot of non-visual communication when communicating remotely. In fact, there's only one thing better than meeting with people in person when it comes to user research, and that's to meet people in their home or place of work. Going to users rather than having them come to you makes a world of difference. First, users are more relaxed, leading to more honest and open conversations. But second, and more importantly, you get deeper insights into them by being able to see their environment. Seeing where people access your website or product allows you to see their context and influencing factors. The environment has a massive impact on somebody's experience, and that is valuable to understand. Not only that, but seeing their environment gives you insights to them as a person. Of course, the problem with interviews and workshops and that kind of thing is that they're very time consuming and also, in the current environment, very hard to do. They also require us to have access to the end user, which we don't always get. So, what can we do if time is limited and access is limited? Well, I find that social media can provide fascinating insights into users and what they want. Noting what people say about your company online will give you insights into their questions and their frustrations. Looking at the profiles of those that interact with your company will also give you insights into who they are. Also, monitoring related keywords to your business will help identify their pain points and goals. Next up, there is site monitoring. We can look at our own sites and learn all kinds of things about users from looking at them. You know, what are people searching on? Which pages do they spend the most time engaging with? What route are they taking through our site? What screen elements hold their attention? All of these things give us insights into how our users are thinking and what they want. The other massive advantage of site monitoring is that you are observing real users completing real tasks. Unlike other research techniques, the user is unaware of our presence and so are not influenced by us. Tools such as Google Analytics or screen recorders like FullStory make this monitoring easy, and so there is little reason not to be running this kind of usability testing on an ongoing basis. Finally, there's user diaries. See, the drawback of site monitoring is you don't get insights into what people are thinking. And even in interview settings, you're only getting a snapshot in time. So one way around this problem is to ask users to keep a diary of their experience for a more extended period. Now, I'll be honest with you, this isn't an approach I use a lot, but it is valuable when trying to improve the experience of a customer. This is especially true when the customer has a prolonged interaction with the company. For example, keeping a diary of buying on an e-commerce site would make less sense, but when purchasing a service from a company, a diary may prove more useful. Now, which of these techniques you use will depend on time, project circumstances, and the availability of users. However, doing anything is better than doing nothing when it comes to user research, so don't feel put off if you can't do that much. Even collating what you already know as an organization will go a long way, as long as it's used to inform decisions. The problem is that too often user research is ignored, which is why visualization is so important. For user research to be useful, it needs to become a part of the decision-making process, and that means it needs to be visible when we're making decisions. Unfortunately, too often user research is confined to some report somewhere that's shoved in a drawer or a slide deck that got presented once. We need to do better than that. As a bare minimum, we should be producing empathy maps. In many ways, empathy maps are like personas. They focus on a fictional or real person and describe various traits about that person. But while personas focus on demographics, an empathy map is about tasks, questions, pain points, and experience. Empathy maps are easy to create, but they do suffer from the same danger as a report. They can end up in a drawer and never get referred to again. To avoid this problem, I recommend turning your empathy maps into designs that can be displayed on the wall. By turning them into posters, you ensure that they're visible and increase the likelihood of them getting consideration. The same is also true for customer journey maps. An empathy map is a snapshot of what we know about user. It summarizes their behavior. However, in reality, behavior changes over time. The questions people ask, the tasks that they're trying to complete, and even how they feel will all alter depending on where they are in the buying process. And so to reflect this idea of the user being on a journey, you can create a customer journey map that represents the stages a user passes through in their experience. It also highlights different critical characteristics of the user at each stage of the journey. What information you capture about the user through their journey is entirely up to you, but often it reflects similar criteria to the empathy map, to be honest. Once again, this needs to be visualized in a way that ensures that everyone takes user research into account during a project. But if you want to adopt a truly user-centric approach, you may wish to consider user story cards. Most projects have some form of specification that outlines what the project will deliver. And that typically focuses on functionality and content. But what if we started from a different premise? What if we started from the user research and specified the project based on user needs? User story cards allow us to do precisely that. They define the project as a series of statements about what a user wants to do. Each statement consists of three parts: the audience, the task, and the objective. So, for example, one of many user story cards for my own blog might read something like, I'm a digital project manager, the audience. I want to sign up to the newsletter, the task, so that I can keep up to date with the latest user experience design techniques, the objective. A single project might have many audiences, and each audience might want to complete many different tasks. So the result can be a large number of tasks and story cards. However, by framing the project with story cards, you embed user research into the final deliverable. Look, I'm aware that this is quite a long talk, sorry about that, and it's still far from comprehensive. However, it should act as a kind of introduction to user research and the tools available to you. Hopefully, it will encourage you to do at least some form of user research before starting your next project. The most important thing to remember is that even a little research is better than none. If nothing else, it demonstrates the value to you and your stakeholders. And hopefully, that will encourage some future investment further down the line. So before we move on to your interview, Marcus, I'm quite interested whether you had anything you feel needed to be added to that talk, or any comments or anything that you felt needed to be reinforced.
I liked all the stats at the start. £300 million Amazon and all that. Oh, was it more than that? I don't know. It was just like, well, that got my attention anyway.
Yes.
Oh, that was cool. I diligently took notes. I did my homework, Paul. As everyone else who listening to the show will be doing. Now, a couple of things, interesting points came out of existing research. That's something that I think even clients are kind of a little bit guilty of forgetting they've done it. We did that a year ago, so it's not relevant. So you do need to spend 3 weeks doing it again. And I think that more time needs to be spent, and I guess agency people, consultants, people like us need to kind of push more on that. What have you done? You know, what can go into this melting pot before we start working out what research we need to do? So that's a really interesting point and something we should do, because often there's gold in there. Or there is a case of, that department over there did something. Like, I don't know what it was. And it's like, and if you go and look at it, it's like, well, they've done all the stuff that you were about to hire us to do. So maybe we should look at this again. One other point, and this, I cover this in the interview with James. This thing about usability testing as a research tool, I think it really is. Because obviously half the time we're reworking something that exists half the time. 95% of the time we're reworking something that already exists. So watching users use that thing is often the best form of research. And it blows my mind every time, because I'm like, no, it's that. You should be touching that thing over there or whatever. Always, every time. And I go back to our team and say, well, you know, we thought this. It's not like that at all. People aren't seeing that thing or whatever, relating to any kind of usability testing now. It speaks, just volumes over volumes, especially compared to talking to people who know the thing. You know, stakeholder interviews, yes, they're very important, but watching users use things is what I think the thing I took away from that the most as a really valuable research tool.
And just circling back to the stats that I quoted at the beginning of that particular piece, if you want to know where all those stats come from, because they're really useful, aren't they, for presenting to senior management and that kind of thing. So if you go to that URL I gave at the beginning of the show, boag.world/lean-UX. I've linked to each lesson in the course there, and you can go through, view all of the related material, which includes links to all of those stats, so that you can throw them in the face of various managers and clients as you see fit. Okay, so that is my kind of introduction to lean user research, but we didn't just want my perspective on the show. We wanted to get other experts involved in this as well. And so, Marcus, you've done an interview. You mentioned that it was with someone called James. Mm-hmm. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's with James Box, ex-Clear Left. Now, runs a consultancy called Burst, BERST, which he'll talk about a little bit. I met James 15 years ago, I think, when he first started at Clear Left. And we've had him on the show in the past, and he's lovely. And this is kind of like my first one-to-one interview. And I thought, well, I want someone lovely then.
This person, I mean, he happens to be really good at this subject as well. This is his area of expertise.
The main reason, that was reason number one. But the main reason is the fact that he wrote a book back in 2011, with Kenneth Bowles, called Undercover User Experience Design, which was really kind of about doing UX design in a lean kind of way. So it was like, he was the first person that kind of started talking about this stuff, or wrote about it anyway. So he'd be a good person to get on.
Absolutely. So here's the interview between Marcus and James Box.
Okay, on this first interview in this new series, where I've been tasked with speaking to people, which is a new thing for me, I thought, well, I better see if I can think of someone who's friendly to the show, someone who's been here before, someone who can hold my hand through this process. And I thought of James Box, who I've known for 15 years now. Hello, James. How are you?
Hello, Marcus. It's lovely to speak to you again.
Yeah, I've also thought of you for other reasons, but we'll come on to that a little bit later. I think I first met you maybe at South by Southwest back in the good old days when Clear Left and Headscape, the whole teams, would fly out to America. Or maybe it was before that. Can you remember?
I would guess South by Southwest as well. And I think that would be a good way to frame it, because they were some good times, and like you say, good old days. I'd like to think that we met in some, you know, saloon bar, talking to, you know, entertaining a bunch of people, you know, Americans, with our wit and repartee. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I just love your accent and that kind of thing. Yeah, I think you started off, correct me if I'm wrong, as an information architect at Clear Left, and at the time we were really keen to get an information architect on board, and I remember Andy Budd getting very upset with me about you can't steal him and all this kind of stuff, which did make me giggle at the time.
Oh, well, that's an honor. I've had various job titles over the years. I think information architect is certainly one that I've had on a business card at some point. And you know, it probably doesn't mean a lot to people these days. I still think it's a discipline that is part of what we do is design, but it doesn't really get mentioned so much. But you know, it's been, yeah, information architect, interaction designer, UX designer. Yeah, before moving into, I guess, a little bit more towards the management side of things. So, but yeah, I was an information architect and still proud of that in some ways.
Yeah, well, I put it on my CV. I haven't had a CV in over 20 years, it would be on my CV as something that I can do as well. So what, before Clear Left, because I can't remember, you probably told me this before, and my apologies, but how did you get into this kind of web thing? Because everyone's got an interesting story usually about, I mean, my one is just mad, but how did you end up getting into the kind of web world?
Mine was sort of, I guess, a bit of ball of luck, really. Around the year 2000, I was ambling around with very little direction and bumped into a course that was being run by Middlesex University, a postgraduate course called Design for Interactive Media. And I didn't have anything better to do, and I decided to take a master's and retrain myself. And I can remember the point when I applied for that course, not really knowing how to do that, because it was an electronic application. I didn't really know the difference between the email, between the web, and yeah. So, and that was my routine, and it was a great course for a year, which we kind of learned the fundamentals of, I guess, digital design, HCI, mm-hmm. probably at that time. Part of that was usability and accessibility, and I think that was probably the sort of platform through which I started experimenting with user experience design. A brief dalliance in the startup world with a small product that myself and a couple of others set up, and then from there on in it was agency. At the time, the Disability Discrimination Act was starting to be enforced in the UK, and there was a strong impetus around accessibility, but more broadly speaking, usability, and yes. That opens the door to information architecture and to user experience design. And so, yeah, that was the springboard into this world. And yeah, I joined Clear Left around, I would say 2000 and, oh, I'm going to guess around 2005, something along those lines. And of course, user experience design then at that point became a well-established discipline. And yeah, and you know, from there on in, that's really been my focus.
Well, that's cool. I mean, and the other reason, apart from you being so nice and kind and holding my hand through this process of the first interview, the other reason that you sprang to mind, you were literally the first person I thought of, and you kindly agreed, because this whole series is about this idea of doing UX design on a budget, lean UX, if you like. Not necessarily kind of like, you know, doing a design project where there's no limitation on design. What should we be focusing on? What are the valuable things to be doing? And I just thought, well, the first time I ever really came across that term, and I don't think you actually coined the phrase lean UX, but you wrote a book with Kenneth Bowles called Undercover User Experience Design, and that's what it was about, all of this stuff. So I thought, well, James is the man then that I want to get onto the show. Look, I don't buy many books, but I'm showing it. Look, there it is, my copy of your book. So it had a profound impact. That sounds maybe a little bit too strong, but a lot of the things you talked about in this book, we took on board at Headscape and thought, right, we were doing some of it, but some of the things were like, oh yeah, that's a great idea, we'll take that on board. So it had a big effect on me and the work we did at Headscape, and I think it was the first time that people started thinking about this idea of doing UX design maybe on a budget. I keep trying to avoid this on a budget thing, because it's more a case of doing the best work is how I see what you were trying to get across within this book. So that was about 2010, 2011 you wrote mm-hmm. that?
Yeah.
What was it that inspired you to write the book?
So I think at the time, user experience design was an emerging practice, but it was very rare for people to have that job title, and I was one of the few people that I knew that had that job title. And a lot of the work that we were doing at the time was trying to instill that mindset and those methods into the clients that we were working with. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was what we thought of as going undercover. And undercover meant not using the title of user experience design, because it was unfamiliar and disorientating for people.
Right.
And so in some ways, the whole premise of the book is around, I guess, the principle of asking for forgiveness, over permission, really. And I think that's a principle that I still use today. Whether you call yourself a user experience designer or not, you can still apply those practices. And so it was an attempt to sort of introduce user experience design stealthily, and sort of trying to play on the whole undercover secret agent metaphor.
Is that something that you want to be a secret agent from a boy?
Of course, yeah, and probably still do in some ways. Yeah.
I don't know how. Yeah, old. I'm not sure how old you are, James, but when I was a boy, there was a comic called Warlord, where you would get sort of like spy type equipment sent to you each week with you buy it off the shelf, and it would be like a little plastic bag with some kind of spy equipment, like invisible ink and that kind of thing.
I don't remember Warlord, but I do remember having a very I got a very vivid memory of desperately wanting a digital watch that could play the James Bond theme tune. I saw it advertised in the back of a newspaper or comic or something, and spent a long time trying to convince my parents that this was an important life stage for me to have this digital watch. So.
And did you get it?
I don't think I did, to be honest. No. Yeah, I should look out for one now. But
definitely.
Yeah, so I mean, Undercover was really was playing on that idea. But like you say, there was, unbeknownst to us at that point, a link into this concept of lean, which in some ways I think if we'd written the book 2 years later, we may have even used that as a more explicit way to describe what we were doing. But I think it's also worth mentioning that lean is a field that has a very sort of is a very broad, all encompassing management methodology. Really, it's not necessarily something which we think of when we talk about Lean UX, but some of the principles that have arisen through the practice of Lean are applicable to our field. And so you have these kind of subsets, which I think, you know, Lean Startup is the one that I tend to use a lot these days, but Lean UX, which was a book written by Jeff Gottelf a few years after our book, has taken some of those the principles and practices around the lean management ideals and applied them to our discipline. And I think a lot of those are similar to some of the ideas that we talked about in Undercover User Experience Design, but it's fair to say that they have evolved a lot since then.
Well, that brings me on to my next question, actually. Particularly the kind of methods and processes that you talk about in the book, do you think they still stand today?
It's actually quite hard for me to remember the book in a lot of ways. I'll
randomly open a page.
I remember some aspects. And so I think, you know, the idea of forgiveness over permission, I would say, is a solid principle that I've benefited from over time. And I think that underpins a lot of the thinking in the book. I think there's some ideas in there that we talk about at the start around sort of manifesto, very ambitious, but you know, the ideas of good over great, I think will still apply to the way I work today. You know, not trying to get stuck into trying to perfect and idealistic realms. There's a model in the book called the validation stack, which I think is related to what we're talking about today in terms of research. And the basic principle is that there are three lenses through which you can validate your work with sort of increasing levels of importance. So the bottom layer in there will be best practice. So there's heaps of best practice out there that you can apply to your work. And if you're using best practice, you can be pretty confident that you're standing on the shoulders of giants, if you like, or standing on the body of research that has preceded you. And that's a good thing to do. But if you have user research, which is the next layer up, that should then trump really anything that you're doing in terms of best practice. Mm-hmm. And the layer above that would be user evidence. So if you have evidence that is, you know, through user research or testing, that would imply that the solution you're taking should be adjusted. That would trump any research that you've done or any best practice. So it's this kind of hierarchy that we use to apply to what we're doing. And I think that still stands today. If you have evidence, that's, you know, that's always going to be one of the most important signals to take into account when you're making a design decision.
Okay, you're right. The whole premise of today's show is we're meant to be looking at the kind of research aspects of the Lean UX design process. And your book covers that in spades. Is there a couple of points I want to kind of go to. The first one I want to ask you is if you were going to make it really lean and you were after that piece of you know, user-related evidence, if you could only do one thing, what would it be?
That's a difficult question to answer, but I would, for me personally, there's nothing more impactful than sitting alongside a customer, a user, you know, a participant, and being able to have some kind of exposure to them using the product and or discussion in and or around that product. So some qualitative interviews, observation, to me that's really as close as you can possibly get to the raw behavior of your you know, that you're designing to design around. So I would always opt for something qualitative, ideally face to face, over and above something like surveys or, you know, remote work if possible. And that's, that to me is the kind of rawest feedback you can get.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go, really, with my second point. We put a lot of effort into research, which is right. But I've often found over the years, exactly as you describe, sitting down and let's say the project is to redesign something that already exists. The most valuable research is watching a genuine user use the existing product, I've found. And it's kind of like, well, so therefore, maybe we should be spending a lot more time in the kind of prototyping phase and going back to checking how users are, how their behavior changes based on that initial piece of research on seeing them use it, is something that I think we should be maybe doing more of, particularly if budget is low. Because I spend so much time doing surveys, doing top task analysis, all that kind of thing, which is great. And it does help, I think, you know, certainly the prioritization of tasks and stuff like that. But actually, really watching people do use the product, I'm basically agreeing with you, is the most valuable thing.
I think the other techniques that you're talking about there can be equally as valuable. And if you can combine qualitative and quantitative, then you start to get into some areas which become really valuable. But if you're giving me the dilemma of one thing, it would be you know, that in person. I think the other aspect to think about here is that I think there are two lenses through which you can use research. The first one is potentially more in the realm of usability testing, which is you're looking to validate whether a design decision is in effect working as you intended, and in that case you're really looking to examine the effectiveness of a solution. But I think the other way to think about research, and actually the way that I think the most important, is really to understand whether you're solving the right problem in the first place.
Sure.
And that level of detail, the why are we doing this, is something that's very difficult to get from quantitative data. And so the observation and the in-person, you know, sort of interviews, those kind of things, to me, always give that clearer indication of what's the underlying need, what's the underlying motivation, what is the problem we're trying to solve here, which I think is the most powerful part of research if you can use it in that way. It's not often how people start. They normally start in that former in the idea of kind of usability testing. But I think if you can start to take research and apply it for really helping to define the problem that you're solving, and to get really under the skin of the needs of what people are, you know, what's the problem they're trying to solve, what's the need they want fulfilled, I think that's really where research starts to become very, very powerful.
I agree entirely. And we're rapidly running out of time, I'm afraid. I could talk about this all day. Can you, just before we wrap up, can you just give me a little bit about, because you're no longer at ClearLeft, you haven't been for a while, what are you doing these days, and how can people get in contact with you if they want to do stuff like that?
Yeah, so I left ClearLeft around a year and a half ago now, and alongside my business partner, James Bates, we have established what we call a venture design studio, and we're called Burst, B-E-R-S-T. And we focus on helping our partners innovate now. Broadly speaking, we work with three types of people. We work with startup and spin-out founders to help them turn their ideas into businesses. We help investors who have a portfolio of investment and are looking to try and apply design to improve the return on that portfolio. And then we still help leadership teams and management teams who are looking to bring innovation into their organization. So we're very much focused on on the innovation side these days, and that means we apply research in more in the kind of lean startup style to the work mm-hmm. that we do. And we've been doing that now for about a year and a half, and really enjoying it.
It sounds kind of more like a consulting role than a design role. Is that a fair assessment?
It can be, yeah. I mean, we work at three levels, really. So we can be advisors. So there are some startups that we work with, which we have, you know, a regular, almost coaching aspect to what we do, where we speak to them on a sort of, okay. you know, fortnightly basis. Sometimes we are facilitators, which means that we might come in and help a team through a specific problem. We may run a project or something like a design sprint for them to help them overcome a well-defined problem. But we're still collaborators as well. You know, we like to go in and get our hands dirty and get in the trenches and do design work as well. So those three layers, yeah. And so there is some consultancy, but there's still some, I'm still a practitioner in a lot of ways as well.
It sounds like you've got all best of all the worlds. Well, thank you very much, James. Where can people find out more?
Our website is ber.st. Mm-hmm. And you can email me at box@ber.st. There's two founders at Burst, and we're both called James, so we've gone for the surnames there. I'm on Twitter at Boxman as well. So
brilliant. Okay, well, thank you again. Really appreciate it. Cheers, James.
Not at all. It's really nice to speak to you, Marcus, and yeah, look forward to listening to the podcast.
So I thought that was absolutely excellent, Marcus. Thank you so much for doing that. I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the interviews. It's very new for me because you're doing all the work and I'm just kind of sitting back and listening to it. So it was really good. I thought it was an absolute excellent interview, and I thought he raised some really good points. One thing that I thought was brilliant is that you don't need the title of UX professional to do UX work. And I think there are a lot of people out there that are doing UX work. You're one of them.
Yes.
You know, that maybe don't have that in job title. There's a lot of marketers out there these days, especially that realize the importance of user experience. So if you are one of those people, drop us an email at paul@boagworld.com. I would love to hear from you and what your role is. The other thing that I took away from the interview was that, which he did circle back to several times, but is worth emphasizing one last time, is that ask for forgiveness and not permission, which is so true when it comes to user experience stuff. Just do it under the radar. Don't try and get permission before you do it. And the analogy that I always use is, you know, when it comes to design, your manager doesn't tell you which design tool to use, right? You know, you're not told whether you should use Word or another word processing app. You're not told, you know, how to divvy up your day. So why can they tell you whether or not you should be doing user research? You know, it's part of your job. It's the way you deliver the job for which you were hired. And so just go ahead and do it. And if they tell you off later, then, as James Box puts it, ask for forgiveness.
It applies to everything, you know, image rights, music,
yep.
Driving lessons, you know, just get out there and do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the final thing that he said that I took away was this idea of solving the right problem in the first place. That you know, that the reason user research is so important is because you get to understand whether the project that you're doing even has any validity to it. And the number of projects that go on in organizations that just shouldn't happen is staggering. So there you go. That is our interview with James Box. The final thing that we want to do in this lesson, and indeed in all future lessons, is take a little step back. So there were a whole load of subjects that we wanted to cover as part of this truly Lean UX course, but didn't fit into the main kind of flow of topic for each episode. So what we've decided to do is partner with the wonderful people at Balsamic, which is why there is no no sponsor or advertising in which we've always done in the past, because Balsamic are supporting us through the whole season. And essentially we've worked with them to record a series of little kind of one-off mini interviews on different related subjects to Lean UX. And today's interview is going to be on content first design. Okay, so in the first of these little asides that we're doing when we're looking at related subjects, we start with an interview with Billy. Billy, what's your second name? I don't actually know what your second name is.
It is Carlson, and I like that you call it a second name.
Last name.
Yeah, see, I love that. See, that's something I would think of in UX too, filling out a form and be like, what is my second name? I don't know.
Yeah, Billy, that's a very good
point. My name's William. That's great. Sorry. That's a little bit of another side.
So we want to have a quick chat, if we can, about content-first design. You've written really good posts that I very much enjoyed over on the Balsamic Learn Academy that they've got over there. Tell me, what is content-first design? What do you mean by that term?
Sure. Well, it's really quite simple. It's just an approach where the content of the project determines the design or layout of it. So you'll plan things out like the words you're going to use, maybe even photos, icons, data tables. The reason is the content you use, the tone of it, the length of it, all of this plays a big role in shaping the UX. So focus on content before sketching a wireframe or writing code. Hopefully, it should allow you to deliver content in a clear, a much more concise way.
So, I mean, the big problem is that that means you have to have content before you start designing. So, how do you deal with that in practical terms? Do you tend to kind of, the way I approach it is I kind of just go ahead and draft some content on their behalf, and then they tell me it's wrong. Is that how you do it, or do you take a different
approach? It's interesting. I've had so many different types of experiences. I always push for this now because it just saves so much time. And what I try to do is involve everyone. So some people are more visual. They just assume they're more visual. But if you say like, well, what is on the homepage? Let's write it out. Okay, they're going to have a hero image, but what's the headline? This is a great time to have a content designer on your team, or someone who's a writer that will help you push through this stuff. But again, the reason why I tell people is it'll save a lot of time in the design phase and probably the implementation phase. So it's difficult to convince stakeholders sometimes, but if you say this will really help shape the design in the future, because you won't be trying to cram content into a layout it wasn't designed for, which is the problem that we usually have in the design phase. You'll save a lot of time, and this project will move much quicker if we just sit down and focus on it now.
Are there other benefits, do you think, to taking this kind of content first approach, or is it really about those kind of time savings?
I think there's a lot of benefits. So one of the things that I challenge people to do is say, can you answer a few simple questions? What exactly are we trying to communicate? You know, who are we talking to? What story do we want to tell them? Stories, you know, in UX and design and life are really important. We should have a story that we're trying to tell. And then what action do we want them to take? And if you challenge someone to do that and they have a really hard time answering those questions, which is pretty common, they're like, all right, maybe we should take a step back and really understand the purpose of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah. The other one that we were talking about in the rest of the show that is what do users want to know? You know, before you can create the content for a website, you need to know what the user wants to know. And before you can structure the website, you need to know what the content is. Before you can design the website, you need to know what the structure is. You know, we do it completely back to front, don't we, when we start with a pretty picture, you know?
Yeah, and that's the thing. We talk about that in wireframing all the time is, the reason why wireframing is so impactful is because you don't get distracted by, you know, colors and icons and photos and the gloss of it, which, I mean, I'm a visual designer at heart, so I love that stuff. But I, you know, after years of working, I realized, well, that doesn't really resonate the same with everybody, but the structure and how you approach walking someone through a website or an app or software is the main thing, you know, like the UX, the user flows, all these things. And helping shape the content first really helps everything fall into place.
So how does somebody start to adopt a content first mindset, whether it be us as the designers or our clients and stakeholders? How do we get into that way of working?
Yeah, sure. So like I said, I always want them to start off with answering some questions. You know, who are we talking to? What do we want them to know about us? I'm very big on story for almost every type of product you can build. And the big thing, what actions they want to take. It's funny is I do this. I've been a designer for a long time. I used to do brand design. I started out in graphic design. I do the same thing if someone asks me to design a logo. I do pretty much the same thing because I'm trying to get into their, we have to all have a collective understanding of the purpose before we can really move forward. It's hard to push for that, I can tell in my experience, but I still try. And then from there, so I really would feel like, okay, I feel like we know what our purpose is. Maybe let's start creating a sitemap so we can know all the pages that we're going to need to achieve whatever we want the user to achieve. From there, I kind of have like where I split off is if it's a totally new project, you know, maybe you're stuck, try something like a competitive analysis to push you through, see what's already out there. There's a link to a template for competitive analysis in the article, so check that out. Another big one that I push for if it's you're working on a redesign, and I feel like redesigns are a lot more common than anything, is do a content audit. Spend the time to read all of the content you already have and analyze it. I think reviewing current state for any project is a great way to understand, you know, what is now, what do we want to keep, what do we want to change, where do we want to be? Things, again, like tone and the length of your content are really important. So this is a good point to really understand what you've done. So from there, like say your team spends, you know, all the time and develops content. Again, it's a really long process. It's not quick and as easy as I make it sound. Then you're sort of ready to start designing. You know, now you can start moving to the visual phase, I think.
And you're not suggesting the content has to be entirely finished and polished, one presumes. We're talking about getting the structure and the initial draft in place.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think it should be thought through. You know, I always say, like, let's try not to have any lorem ipsum anywhere. Like, let's write it out. Because otherwise, that headline that you think is going to be two lines is one, and then it looks weird. And there's a lot of, and I think all of us who work on digital products know that if something small changes, it just has a ripple effect. So like, oh, I was expecting that article to be twice as long, and now the page is half as long. And I can see the footer, and I don't want to do that. And there's a lot of that happens, I think, is a snowball effect. So
yeah. Do you kind of get into things like listing out the benefits that the particular company provides or its features, or, you know, do you do things like elevator pitches? You know, here's a one strap line that kind of sums up people. Because I often think, I personally find that a really great way of distilling down what these people offer. Because when you ask a lot of people, it turns into quite a long list.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, so I kind of take a different approach, but similar, is I always say, think of a story you're trying to tell. So I was recently speaking with like an IT consulting firm about their design. It was actually a really fun project we did at Balsamic. And like you go onto their page, they do great work, but it lists like every little thing that they do. Like we do this and we do this and we do this. And I'm like, oh, I don't, too much. Tell me a story, like your favorite story about the client you helped. So it is sort of like an elevator pitch. Yeah. Like I would use that, like, all right, for example, we had Mr. Anderson and we did this, and it walked me through that. And I'm like, oh, I want to learn more. Tell me another story, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a really good way of thinking about it. I like that. Because I think a lot of people talk about storytelling on the web, but don't really explain what that means. You know, it can sound very pretentious if you, you know, but telling the story of a client and the client's experience, works extremely well. Okay, that's absolutely excellent. If you want to read the whole article, because it's very much worth reading, you can go to balsamic.com/learn/articles/content-first-design. A nice, easy to read URL for an audio podcast. But nonetheless, Billy, thank you very much for coming on and introducing it. It's a really great concept, and hope we'll speak again soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Paul.
Perfect. Thank you.
That was fun.
Cool. Excellent.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, it was perfect. Yeah, absolutely. We were about the right length, short, sweet, pushes them in the right direction, hopefully get them reading stuff. So do you work full-time for Balsamic then?
Yeah, I'm full-time. Loving it. I'm like a year in now. It's crazy.
And so what are you doing for a bit? It sounds like you're working almost on client side stuff. How does that work?
So yeah, we actually did, I usually don't, but Leon had this idea last November, I think, to put in the newsletter, like, hey, the first 10 people to respond will do like what you were doing, like a site review, and it'll be private. And it was so fun. It was like, you know, we had 10 totally different companies, and the one I was talking about was actually in Chicago where I'm based, which was crazy. And I was like, there's too much here. You need to narrow it down. Tell me a story, like walk me through it. So.
Excellent. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. Can you just pop that audio file into Dropbox or something and fling it over, and we'll get this edited up and into the podcast for Thursday.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I'm really excited that we're doing this. This should be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you think you'll be doing some of the other ones with us then as well?
I think Leon and I are splitting it, so I'll probably do it.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon then.
All right. Take care.
All right. See ya. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. So that wraps up our first lesson in this course on Lean UX. I hope you found it useful and informative. I am going to set you some homework for between each show. The thing is with these courses, you get to the end of a lesson, it's like, that was very interesting. And then you don't implement anything that you have learned. And and then it becomes a waste of time. You know, what's the point of spending your valuable commute listening to this when you could be listening to, you know, Smashy and Nicey? Sorry, that's a really dated reference that a lot of people won't get. So I wanted to give you something tangible to go away and do. And Marcus has actually already mentioned what you should be doing, which is really go away and collate what you already know about users, right? Before you rush in and start doing some more user research, just take a moment to see what you've already got in your organization, because you may well be surprised. You may well find that there is a lot more information, either in the heads of various individuals or alternatively, previous research that's been done. So before next show, try and get that done. Talking of next show, what we're going to be looking at next time is defining success. Before you can create an outstanding user experience, you first of all need to know what the business needs from your website or your application or whatever it is that you're building. And so we're going to look at that in the next show, which will be coming out on the 28th of May. So remember now, the shows are monthly. But there is one thing that we have to do before we go, because otherwise we would lose every single one of our existing listeners. This is so if you're new to the podcast because you're interested in the course, I apologize for what's about to happen.
You can just leave now. That's fine.
Yeah. Just turn off now, right? You don't need to know what's going to happen next. Nobody will, because their curiosity will get the better of them. So what we always do, and we've always done it, is we've done a terrible dad joke at the end of each episode. And for some reason, every time I try and drop this from the show, this is Marcus's thing, and I've desperately tried to remove it time and time again, we get so many complaints that I dare not get rid of it.
I know.
So, Marcus, what is today's dad joke?
I need to work out how many episodes we've had, because then I can work out how many jokes I've told. Could even be a Guinness record of the number. It isn't, is it? This is from Daryl Snow, who's been a bit of a stalwart of the joke providing over the years. Guy pulls over side of the road, pulls up his car, gets out, notices that there's something on the side of the road. So he phones up the RSPCA, that's an animal charity in the UK, and says, "I've just found four badgers in a suitcase by the side of the road." And the operator says, "Are they moving?" He says, "Well, that would explain the suitcase."
Okay. I feel like we just undermined the entire professionalism of the rest of the show, but there you go. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today for this first lesson. Please let us know what you think of the new format. Hopefully you like it because we're committed to it now, so there's no going back. But we'd love to hear anyway. Drop me an email at paul@boagworld.com. And remember to find out more about this season and to get detailed support material on each episode, go to boag.world/lean-UX. And if you fancy more waffle and chat, join the Slack channel at boagworld.com/slacking. But until the 28th of May, thank you for listening and goodbye. BoagWorld.com.